Now I get to introduce myself, which is awkward at best. I'm Suzette Moorman. I'm a research geologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. Prior to joining the USGS, I was employed as a registered nurse in a variety of healthcare settings. I received my master's in geology from the University of Alabama and my master's in public health at the School of Public Health at the University of Colorado. What I'm going to talk to you about today is my work that I did on Ginger's project, who you just heard from, on the bioaccessibility and the concentration of metals in these dusts. What we tried to do, we had, I believe, about a dozen filters, which doesn't give me an N equals very high, but to look at these from a variety of analytical techniques to get as much information as we could about them in terms of potential effects on human and ecosystem health in a system that's changing from what you have heard is was a primarily natural system to one that is now more a geoanthropogenic system. And this is based on the fact that we know that earth materials, air, dusts, and soils actually do contain both natural and anthropogenic known and potential toxicants, and that sometimes these materials have not been very well characterized or described. Exposure to particulate matter, as Ginger very well described, and we actually cite the same paper, has been generally accepted to cause exacerbations in cardiovascular and respiratory disease. Primarily, this research is focused on urban areas, and not much attention has been given to rural areas where there are high dust concentrations in the air or the crustal component. It's long been thought that this crustal component was too large to be of concern. Our focus is more geogenic, so we look at earth materials that are both naturally produced from dust emission or ash from wildfires and volcanoes, as well as geoanthropogenic, things that are produced by human impact or human practices such as dried lake beds and desertification, which we've heard about a bit today, and I'll talk about more. This is just a little bit of a background for those of you not familiar. The National Clean Air Act mandated that EPA monitor and regulate six criteria pollutants. The one we're concerned with here is particulate matter. There are two regulated particle sizes. One is PM10, which is less than 10 micrometers and greater than 2.5, and PM2.5. And why is particle size so important? The figure here, in case you're not familiar with how big a micrometer is, this is courtesy of the EPA. This is a human hair, which is 50 to 70 micrometers in diameter. This is a piece of beach sand, which is 90 micrometers in diameter. So you're talking about very, very tiny particles. The reason they're important is that, for the most part, particulates that are PM10 get trapped in the nasopharyngeal region and in the mucus lining, and they're either expectorated or swallowed. Unless you're doing heavy exertion outdoors, or you're participating in sports outdoors, in which case you might be mouth breathing and breathe in larger PM10 particles. So only the very tiny particles manage to traverse the into the bronchi, and there again, they're still subjected to a number of processes such as sedimentation, and interception. So only the very fine particles that don't get exhaled back out do make it down into the alveolar space. As Ginger, I think, showed this map clearly as well, what we're looking at is dust coming over from the Sahel region, and this dust composition and quantity is known to be changing. And much of it is attributed to this process of desertification. This is a slide from Mene and Bertinelli, who did an article for the World Health Organization on the effects of desertification. Desertification has been in the international spotlight for a number of years now. In fact, in 1994, the United Nations formed a convention to combat desertification, in which 191 nations participated. So this slide depicts some of the processes that lead to desertification, as well as local effects. But I hope from what you've heard today, it's starting, the process is actually affecting other than regional folks that are living in the regional area, and long-term long-term transplant is likely to be a big factor, in if not now, then certainly in the future. So the toxicology of geogenic materials is much the same as anything else. It's a function of the pathway, whether it's inhaled, ingested, or dermal. The intensity, whether it's acute, or the duration, whether it's acute or chronic. Particle size, as I just described, is also very important, whether it's actually inhaled down into the alveolar space. And also particle solubility, which is what much of my work focuses on. Is it actually soluble in our body fluids and available for the body for uptake? So we had these 12 filters, and we decided to try and use as many analytical techniques as we possibly could in order to gain as much information as we could. We looked at particle size analysis using a scanning electron microscopy technique. A colleague of mine in Reston, Virginia, did a cell line toxicity study using human lung epithelial cells. And at my lab here in Denver, we did a total chemistry analysis, as well as I conducted a bioaccessibility extraction, which, as I mentioned, determines the solubility in physiologically based fluids, similar temperature and pH. This is a photograph from the scanning electron microscope. These long fiber things here are actually part of the quartz fiber filter. And the tinier particles here are the actual dust particles. Here on the bottom, I want to draw your attention. This is a 25 micrometer bar, so that's how tiny these things are. Retrieving the particles from the filter was quite the task. We weren't able to do an especially quantitative analysis, but we were able to determine that the majority of the particles were less than 3 microns. And they were composed primarily of these materials, clays, quartz, iron oxides, which are important because they can act like little sponges, especially for metals, and feldspars and a variety of other small particles. Now, the human cell toxicity study, as I mentioned, was done in Reston. I'm not a cellular biologist, so I will give you a short summary that my colleague gave me. There was not a significant difference on the two tests he used, Almar Blue and I'm blanking on the other one, I apologize, in percent growth inhibition or proliferation. What he did see, though, on microscope was indications of cell stress. So obviously whatever action was occurring on these cells was not significant enough, at least for these particular cells, to cause cell inhibition or growth. In terms of total chemistry, I broke this down by the source region here in Mali, in Tobago, and St. Croix. And I looked at in particular a number of metals that typically are have potential to be toxicants in human and in ecosystems for animals. And what we saw in general was that for the majority of metals, there tended to be a slight downward increase in concentration as you moved from the source site to the endpoint site. However, when you look at arsenic and cadmium, they stayed fairly consistent. And this is important because we know both arsenic and cadmium do affect human health as well as animal health. This is another slide, a little bit busy, of the averages from the filters for the total chemistry. So this is total element chemistry. And to give you some comparison of how these numbers compare, this is the U.S. soil mean. So this is the average concentration in soils here in the United States. And the majority of the dusts did exceed what we consider background soils here in the United States. These numbers I have here in the middle are something that the Environmental Protection Agency recently came out with, and they're called ecological soil screening levels. So these are to be protective of soil invertebrates, birds, and small mammals in particular. And what I've done here in red are where the dusts actually exceed those levels. Now, in terms of the soil screening levels for humans, only arsenic really exceeds that background level. The most recent soil screening level, they've done away, it seems like, with the non-cancer risk number, and they're only using the cancer risk number. These are dusts, though, so how fair of a comparison that is, I'm not sure, but I did want to at least give you some comparisons to understand where these filters, where these concentrations sit in terms of a reference point. So bioaccessibility is a measure of the physiological solubility, as I mentioned, of the metal at the portal of entry into the bottom. It's not bioavailability. Bioavailability is the actual uptake by our target organs, our kidneys and our liver. What the bioaccessibility tests do is determine how soluble something is. And this is important because we've seen, for example, in lead, that not all lead is soluble in the body. Lead sulfides, which are a product of mining as well, are very poorly soluble in the body, where lead carbonates are very soluble. So we looked at two pathways, the ingestion and the inhalation pathway with these filters. We used a method by Drexler from CSU, which uses a gastric simulant fluid with a pH of 1.5 and a particle size of less than 250 microns. And this is because that's thought to be the size that clings to the hands of children, which would be transferred to their mouth during hand-to-mouth behavior. This method has actually been accepted by the Environmental Protection Agency to determine lead bioaccessibility and is currently being evaluated for arsenic. For the inhalation pathway, we used a lung simulant fluid, which is similar to a Gambles solution with a neutral pH and a finer particle size is what we generally use. For this, we actually used the actual filters and the extractions were done on that. What we saw was a wide range of bioaccessibility. This is in the simulated gastric fluid. So we saw a wide range amongst the filters for arsenic, cadmium, chromium, and lead. The general trend, and you can't make a lot of conclusions about 12 filters, was that bioaccessibility increased downstream or downwind, where concentration actually was Concentration was decreasing downwind, while bioaccessibility actually increased downwind. We saw a similar range of percent bioaccessibility. So this is the portion that was soluble in that particular body fluid. And it was similar with the simulated lung fluids, where we had a wide range of bioaccessibility. Now I'm going to use arsenic as an example because I've done work on arsenic before to give you something else to compare this with and why it's important. Two years ago, I participated in a soil survey as part of the USGS Geochemical Landscapes Project, which is looking at creating a better soil registry across the United States. And the total arsenic concentration in those soils that we sampled, this was from a north-south transect across the United States, was 2 to 11 milligrams, which is fairly comparable to what we saw in the filters, 5 to 8 milligrams. However, for bioaccessibility, in 11 of the 20 samples, these, for arsenic, they were less than the method detection limit or reporting limit for the machine. So there was actually no arsenic that was soluble. And the percent bioaccessibility was also very low for those samples. It was 0.9 to 11%. So these dusts obviously contain much more soluble arsenic. And that's similar to what we've seen in dry land dust from the Mojave, which I believe my colleague Rich Reynolds will be speaking about. We saw an increased amount of solubility in the arsenic, both in the simulated gastric and the simulated lung fluid. Public health implications. Arsenic is a known, inorganic arsenic is a known carcinogen, although the monomethyl arsenic is thought to be more cytotoxic and arsenite is thought to be more mutagenic. Arsenic has most recently been associated with cardiovascular disease, including stroke and heart attack, myocardial infarction, and also most recently with diabetes, although some of the studies seem to be somewhat conflicting. And a recent review by Drew et al. Indicates that arsenic has the capacity to influence signal transduction pathways from apoptosis to cellular proliferation. So in conclusion, what we saw in our portion of the filters that we analyzed was that total metal concentration in general exceeded the U.S. soil mean concentrations. And arsenic didn't exceed the soil screening level, but there again, these are dusts, not soils, and soils have components that may not be in these dusts. And several metals did exceed the avian and mammal, but the implications to these populations are not clear, simply because these are thought to be protective, and there's not been a huge amount of studies in this area. So in conclusion, I would just like to point out that particle size and the chemistry and the source are very important. are these regions where they might have high background concentrations that might be transmitted. These samples in particular contained a good amount of soluble arsenic in concentrations greater than what we saw in soils. And the studies, these findings suggest that possibly an additional exposure source might be present that we haven't quantified as yet. We typically think of arsenic in drinking water, and that's how it's usually measured, and we measure arsenic in urine. But are we neglecting maybe a subtle source, but also a very chronic source of arsenic? And with that, I'll take any questions. I'd like to thank my my colleagues and co-authors, Virginia Garrison, Jeff Plumley, Paul Lamont, who's the head of our chemistry department, Ruth Wolf, who's also in our chemistry department, Heather Lowers, who did the SEM microscopy, and Joe Bunnell, who did the cell toxicity studies. So. Yes, sir?
You were talking about the measure the composition of minerals in these fine dusts.
Yes, sir.
And you mentioned that, you know, iron oxide is a significant component. When you get to the smaller size, let's say less than 2.5 microns, is iron oxide, what is the major component there? I'm not sure that what you said, I didn't catch it. Mineral component, once you're down to that size.
It is just the iron oxide
itself,
and they, and in addition to the other, there's a lot of research looking at oxidation reduction reactions that iron oxides can participate in, but they can also act as little sponges.
Well, yeah, sponges
to carry things in.
Layman's term, but I guess I'm interested in. So it's in technically it'd be in relation to the point of zero charge or zero point of charge of those iron oxide materials, which you mentioned the pH of your gastric solution, you know, is very low. And so, you know, those materials are going to have a positive charge, and, you know, many of the metals are in a positive charge. So that's going to make more of the metal available. Is that, and, you know, the relationship between the charge And you call it solubility, but it's not technically solubility. It's kind of dissolution or release of the metals from the surface, right? Equilibria, talking about equilibria.
That is certainly the solution pH, what the physiological pH is.
In relation to the zero point of charge on the
on the particles.
The minerals itself.
Okay.
So have you looked at, and I know you're concentrating on metals, has you ever looked at organics in this way, too?
No, I principally looked at the metals. These tests actually began in the 1900s. I found it most interesting. I used to think that the interest in these in vitro tests, because they are simple and they're fast, and you don't do animal studies with them, was the last decade. But a friend actually sent me a paper where in the 1900s they had a gentleman with a gastric fistula, and they removed gastric juice from him and test lead ore to look at mining safety. And I thought that was pretty phenomenal for back in the 1900s. But in the last two decades is when these gastric tests in particular have seen increased interest, looking in particular at lead. For children's health issues and understanding metal contamination at mine sites and what might be soluble and what might not be soluble. And like I say, the mineralogy is very important often because some minerals, in particular with lead, it depends on what that mineral is, it's how its solubility is, even in a low pH, like a 1.5 pH solution. You're welcome. Any other questions? Yes?
Well, mine is based on my ignorance because I don't know anything about this field, but you said something about the dust, the percentage of arsenic was decreasing as it came further west, I guess, but the bioaccessibility was increasing. Did I understand that right?
That was correct.
Is it because the parts of the that are not generally bioaccessible tend to filter out along the way, all only thing that was left was the bioaccessible stuff?
Well, with arsenic in particular, it stayed fairly steady. With some of the other metals, we noticed some decrease in concentration. This is likely related to interactions in the atmosphere, heavier particles being formed and being dropped out. So we saw some decrease in some of the metals. Arsenic stayed fairly steady.
So that, if that's the case, so then how does the concentration?
Well, the bioaccessibility might increase because bioaccessibility is just a percentage of that concentration that was soluble. So bioaccessibility, what I showed here, was just a percentage of how much of that total was actually in solution.
So why would that increase over distance?
It could be what I believe is related to the particle size. So when the particle size is fine down, you have a greater surface area in the particle.
Oh, okay, got it. Okay, now I understand.
Yes, sir?
Just a question, just modeling about, say, total body arsenic, mm-hmm. and how much could have come from breathing, you know, 5 liters of breathing 20 times a minute for the long term versus, you know, what you might get from water or from other sources, if there's anybody's done anything like that in terms of the body burden.
Most people have looked at, have used urine as a method to measure.
Right.
Most of the studies have been done by OSHA for occupational. We don't have studies that I'm aware of looking at chronic environmental exposure. Smith in 2009, Smith et al., examined, it was urinary arsenic, but they looked at exposure through inhalation in an industrial setting and a gastric exposure, and they found no difference in the cancer rates. So obviously, site isn't as important possibly as concentration or duration.
Right, that was my question.
Yeah.
You could say that, you know, you get 0.00002 micrograms of, you know, arsenic in every breath, multiplying that out times 24 hours times 365, you could get some estimation.
Estimate. I don't know of any such calculation. I know arsenic is still under scrutiny, you know, through all the agencies to try and define these lower no observed effect limits, but it's still being looked at. There's so much that we're just now discovering in this last decade about how arsenic works. And they used to think the methylation process removed it from the tissue and helped your body excrete it, and that was great, but now they're determining that the methylation process might actually be the problem. Okay? Thank you very much.